It's the Bengal Financial Literacy Show coming up next on KISU FM Radio with our host, Chris Chatwin, professor with the Idaho State University College of Business.
Thank you for joining us for this month's episode of the Bengal Financial Literacy Podcast. I am your host, Chris Chatwin, coming to you from KISU here at Idaho State University. This week, or this month, I guess, we have with us Seth Reuter. Seth, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Chris. Glad to be here.
So Seth is a former student here, alum of Idaho State University. Seth, apart from that, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I graduated from ISU, 2003, feels like a century ago. And then I spent a bunch of time at the Federal Reserve covering banks. And now I'm a faculty member at the College of Idaho here, over here in Caldwell, Boise area. Yeah, glad to be with you.
Hey, and we're happy to have you, and anybody listening may have guessed already. So you spent a lot of time analyzing banks, reviewing, I guess, risk, right?
Yeah, so I was in a group where we thought about, so you think about what the central bank does. Banks are really the transmission mechanism of monetary policy. And so, you know, the Fed's job, how monetary policy transmits through the system, banks are super important to monitor, track, and understand what's going on. And so that was, yeah, a big part of my role. And then, of course, the Fed has kind of a prudential oversight role on the largest banks as well, just from a safety and soundness solvency perspective. But both of those functions are pretty intertwined and related.
During your time there, correct me if I'm wrong, during the 2008 financial crisis?
Yeah, so I kind of, when the crisis got going, kind of right after Bear Stearns failed, I was in Chicago on a team looking at banks and figure out when they would fail. And then we would essentially, you know, shoot them in the face and turn them over to the FDIC to then get auctioned off on eBay to get sold.
Okay. I'm gonna say half of that's true, right? possibly
yeah.
No eBay.
No. So that'd be just
the eBay of financial intermediaries.
Yeah, the FDIC. It's confidential. You know, banks actually bid. It's kind of this confidential problem. But yeah, I mean, I think like it is like eBay. They're in there looking at the financials and they're putting bids in there, and so it's like a private
FDIC almost.
Yeah. FDIC ran eBay.
Gotcha. FDIC ran eBay. That's what we're gonna call it.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah.
Well, now, Seth, we've got you on the show to talk about, obviously, then bank failures. We're experiencing some panic, some concern. Three banks now, I think, have failed this year, and that's got a lot of people up in arms. I think purpose of our show today is not to talk about the specifics, like specific banks that have failed and how they failed, but more so being that this is a financial literacy podcast, I want to, if it's possible, bring some calm or some peace, and you'll tell me whether or not there can truly be calm or peace in these moments to our listeners. Is our money safe? Okay. If I've got a bank account, is my money safe? So.
Gotcha. So yeah, you know, when you go ahead and answer that question, maybe I'll just kind of start with that. So yeah, as long as you have, you know, you've got deposit insurance, $250,000, there are, if you're over that, there are things you can do to make sure, you know, you're covered, move it around to another bank or talk to the institution that you, you know, have an account with, and they can help you with options on how to get covered with FDIC, with insurance, whether it's FDIC insurance or NCUA insurance covered, which covers the credit unions. And just historically, there has never been a loss in insured depositories ever since the history of the FDIC and the NCUA. Even Silicon Valley Bank, if you just think about what happened there, right? The bank got placed into receivership on the weekend, like I closed on Friday, and there was a whole lot of worry and panic about a lot of companies meeting payroll. We all had a lot of these accounts. Well, in this case, they were over the deposit insurance level, and by Monday, everybody got paid, got their own money, even the amounts that were insured. But I would just say to viewers, right, just make sure you're insured, and that should give you a lot of safety and comfort, because there's never been a dollar loss on deposits insured by the FDIC or the NCUA.
Okay, so I think that's a couple of really good points to unpackage there. First Insurance. So you mentioned FDIC, so that's going to be insurance offered through banks. And then NCUA is going to be the insurance that's offered through credit unions. So whether I have an account at a credit union or account at a bank, my deposits are insured.
Yeah, those are on the 250 limit. You're covered. Yeah, you're covered.
So if I've got less than $250,000, it's 100% covered. That insurance is guaranteeing that.
Guaranteed, and I would not be worried about being able to get access to it either, because it, you know, the NCUA and the FDIC, knowing how important it is to be able to get your money when you need it, are going to do things to make sure that occurs regardless of what happens with the institutions.
And so then if any of our listeners happen to have more than $250,000 in their bank account, it's important to understand too then that's per account type and per account holder. So, you know, if my wife and I have a joint account, there's now two account holders there, right?
Yep. So you guys, couples are 500,000. Like, so you couldn't open another account at a bank. So say it's an individual, you couldn't have a savings account and a checking account, and those would both be 250. It covers the total relationship with the institution.
Okay. So my wife and I, 500,000, right? If it's a joint account. But if we happen to have $1 million, we need $500,000 in one bank, $500,000 in another, is what you're saying.
Yep. Okay. Yep. That's what you do to move it around and be fully covered.
So peace of mind that comes there knowing that's insured. Who pays for that insurance?
Yes, so the banks or the credit unions that are insured. And so they, think of it just like an insurance fund. That's what the FDIC and the NCUA, technically are. They pay assessment fees, and that assessment fee goes into this deposit insurance fund that's there when bad things happen to cover bank or credit union failures. The institutions do pay that fee. There is right now a little bit of, just a discussion about, because the losses in Silicon Valley Bank were quite big, the FDIC is going to have to raise assessments on banks to cover that. And there's a lot of discussion about maybe passing that on to the largest banks instead of the smaller institutions.
So charging banks that have more deposits, charging them a higher rate, basically.
Imagine them, the ones that really are kind of benefiting from being really big, and the view is being, so if you think of like a really big institution that's viewed as kind of too big to fail, since they're kind of benefiting from that already, they need to carry more of the lion's share of the assessment than the smaller institutions that don't benefit from that kind of too big to fail perspective that people have.
Which I think makes a lot of sense. Certainly too, I mean, just the premise of insurance, it's you charge more to the ones that have more risk. There's more deposits there, that's more risk
more exposure.
Being born.
Sure.
And that's a mandatory thing. So it's not like a bank can say, hey, we're a bank, but we're not going to carry this insurance that everybody else is carrying. So bank regulation says, hey, you want to be a bank in this nation or this state, you got to carry insurance.
Yep. That's part of the trade-off or the agreement a bank makes when they become a bank, right? They get deposit insurance. And for that deposit insurance, they have to kind of be regulated, overseen by the government and be held to important standards, because banks are super important in the economy.
So now for our listeners that are out there, I guarantee next time you walk into your bank or your credit union, you're going to notice the sticker now. You've seen it a million times, but you're going to notice it now either right next to the teller, right by the door. If we're walking into a bank, you're going to see that FDIC sticker. If you're walking into a credit union, you're going to see the NCUA sticker. And you've seen it a million times, you just didn't notice it until now. So, okay, so that's a comforting feeling, okay, knowing, okay, I'm protected in this case. Answer this. I think you already did, but let's answer it again. Let's say worst case scenario, my local bank, where I've got my, maybe I've got a few $1,000 is all, maybe a few hundred, doesn't matter, but I need that. And all of a sudden my bank, I just find out that they've gone bankrupt, they're closed. How soon typically until I have access to that money?
Yeah, almost always it's that Monday. The next one, right? Because the banks typically will fail on a Friday.
That's kind of the typical, give them to the end of the week to see if they can work it out.
Yeah, well, generally, yeah, it's easier. You have to go over the weekend. You have the whole weekend now to actually resolve him.
You got the whole weekend to do your quote-unquote eBay auction.
eBay, yeah. The whole eBay auction starts. And so, yeah, you basically take possession of it Friday. And you've hopefully built some kind of a packet. And you've got the whole weekend now to have bidders come in, bid on it. And so by Monday, the hope is that a new institution has bought it and it's seamless, right? Not a blip in anything. That's kind of the cleanest way for this to work. In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, because that entity was so big, complex, it was closed on Friday, but it was difficult to put a packet together and to give banks, the buying banks, time to buy it. They needed to do a lot of due diligence. And so in that case, the FDIC actually created a new entity, and they opened up Monday as this new kind of bridge bank, which again, it gave everybody access to all their deposits, even the uninsured, that Monday.
I guess worst case scenarios, you know, I'm going Saturday, Sunday without having access to my funds.
Yeah, I mean,
which is painful. Probably can be very painful for many, many, many people.
Could be. Yeah, definitely could be. But yeah, I mean, worst case, you know, going out the weekend and then Monday, though, kind of like clockwork, whether it's going to be part of the new entity or it's going to be, you know, in the case of Silicon Valley Bank, it was a bridge bank that the FDIC ran. They had to run this thing for a period of time until they could finally get the thing acquired by somebody else.
Okay. That makes me feel more comfortable.
Yeah, everybody should feel, yeah.
Because if I watch the news or listen to the radio, and this is certainly not unique to banking, I think this is just media in general. You know, you hear the old adage, if it bleeds, it leads, right?
For sure.
We want to focus on the most negative, the most awful, and create the fear and the panic. But should we be panicked then? Should Americans be panicked right now by what's taking place?
Yeah, so I guess if you just kind of step back and think about what's happened over the last 2 years, rates have went up dramatically, right? Inflation, got to crush inflation. And banks hold a lot of assets that are interest rate sensitive, whether they're loans or securities. In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, they had a whole lot of bonds, treasuries, and mortgage-backed securities. When they invested, you know, they had a bunch of money that they had to, you know, in deposits that came in, and they had to go put it somewhere. Instead of going kind of short on the yield curve where the rate was lower, they went out on the curve, got a higher rate. It's risk and return, you know, that everybody has to think about in your kind of personal finance situation. They went out on the curve. The risk was if rates went up much faster than what they thought, they would decrease in value, and that could affect confidence in the ability of Silicon Valley Bank to meet deposit outflows. That's exactly what happened. Rates went up. Those bonds decreased in value bigger than the actual equity capital base of the institution. Certainly started affecting confidence, and people started questioning, did they have enough money? And once they did that, you know, Thursday, they were kind of done. So that's kind of what's happened. So Silicon Valley Bank is kind of an extreme outlier on that, but all institutions do have some exposure to rates rising because they have loans that are fixed, which also from kind of just a fair value perspective, decrease in value. And, you know, specifically the bonds, which, you know, very transparent, they're traded. You can see the value if you look at the disclosures. So that's what's essentially happened in Silicon Valley Bank. Oh, and then First Republic, you know, they had the case where it was a ton of mortgages to rich people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they
were jumbo mortgages, right?
Jumbos, yeah. Originated at 1.5-2%. Rates went up. In their case, I mean, they didn't even almost have a viable business model because now their cost of funds is 3-4%, and the yields on the assets now are less than that. So that was essentially kind of a slow bleed. But yeah, I mean, basically what's happened across all banks have some exposure to this. But the ones that recently failed are the ones that were really extreme outliers in their exposure.
So is this somewhat similar for older listeners to the savings and loans collapse of the 80s?
It is, although that was much more a real estate driven problem. They had a lot of interest rate risk, and what they did was they tried to grow themselves out of it quickly.
So just writing more loans to...
Writing more loans, right? So they have a whole bunch of loans that are underwater, right? So say they're, you know, now the cost of funds is 3%, loans are at 2%. Their solution was, let's go book a whole lot of loans at 5% really fast so we can get back to having a positive net interest margin. And of course, if you do that quickly, you're going to put on a lot of bad ones. And that's ultimately what swallowed a lot of the SNLs.
So... there is such a thing as bad debt then, apparently.
There's such, yes, there is.
We don't want that bad debt. Interest rate risk, you hit on something I teach my students on when we start talking about different risks. We see this, I think, tied to so many different things. There is a relationship, an inverse relationship between price and interest rates. As interest rates go up, prices tend to go down and vice versa. So obviously it's not the only interest rates going way down is not the only reason housing went up, because you still have supply and demand and
for sure
all kinds of other issues in there, but it certainly impacts it. But the bonds, you're saying, you know, you've got these banks that need to do something with the money that's been deposited there. They invest in bonds that are tied to an interest rate, and when the interest rates go up, the value of those bonds go down.
Yep. And the longer they are on the yield curve, right? So if you invest in a 10-year bond, just like what you teach in personal finance, that bond's going to be a lot more sensitive to rates rising, the price, than a 3-year bond. And the banks chose 10 to 15 years instead of 1 or 2.
Which, you know, from a personal standpoint, if I invest in a bond, if I take my money and I lend it to a company in the form of a bond, I'm getting a set coupon rate or interest rate being paid to me. If the interest rates go up and the value of my bond goes down, it matters, I guess, in the sense of I'm not collecting as much as I could collect if I were to invest today.
Sure.
But it doesn't matter in terms of if I hold that bond until it matures, because if I hold it till it matures, I get back the face value.
Sure.
But for these banks, that's not the case, because they needed to sell these to kind of free up some capital. Am I correct?
Yeah. I mean, just kind of compared to, you know, your personal situation, you would not want to go invest 5 years or 10 years if you needed the money, you know, next week or next month.
Yeah. Right?
That would be a personal decision you would make because you have personal liabilities that you got to think about, right? You know, paying some for things, you know, et cetera. You have to make kind of that decision and trade off. In the case that you did it, you know, you invested it for 5 to 10 years, hopefully you didn't need the money and it was, you know, made sense at the time you did it because you didn't have liabilities that you need to pay out soon. On the bank side, they have these liabilities, you know, their demand deposits. Legally, the demand deposit, the bank has to basically meet those on demand. So banks have to think about this very differently. A lot of them, when you look at a bunch of different depositors that all have different behavioral patterns in terms of pulling their money out for payroll, meeting different kind of financial goals, when you put them all together in a portfolio, they smooth out and banks kind of think, well, that makes them stable and safe. But as we know, what happens when you have this big shock, you know, kind of this exogenous shock where rates go up quickly and people lose confidence in the bank, that whole dynamic is no longer true. And banks got to think about that also. And so this is, you know, this is a kind of a classic case where Silicon Valley Bank did not manage their interest rate risk well at all, or their liquidity risk, because they have a kind of a different dynamic than... Well, I have the same dynamic, right? But they have these liabilities that have to be met on demand, and they're a big part of the investments and the loans that they put out, you know, to invest and make a yield on.
And specifically for Silicon Valley, where they had so many large clients, startup companies, tech companies that have these huge accounts that, you know, is what they're using to meet payroll and everything. That panic created, you know, a good old fashioned run on the bank, right? Where everybody's coming and saying, give me all my money right now.
Yeah. So Silicon Valley Bank, this is kind of interesting. If you look at metrics on uninsured, Silicon Valley Bank had the highest uninsured deposit balance of any bank in the banking system.
Meaning people that were over the $250,000 threshold.
And to your point, because all the clients are startups. So in fact, it's kind of interesting if we just kind of do a little diversion here on Silicon Valley Bank and their client profile. They lend to startups. It's a lot of the what they're doing is they're lending to these startups and they're raising capital. And as they're meeting these different milestones that they have to meet to then get the next round of capital, what Silicon Valley Bank would do is they would lend to them before they got to the milestone. They'd lend to them to kind of before they got the capital raise so they could continue to operate. And a lot of the agreements is when you got the next capital raise, you would have to keep that on deposit in Silicon Valley Bank. That's why the deposits were so think of it as a startup tech company. When they got their next capital raise, you know, we're talking $50 million, $100 million. They would really kind of require them to keep that on deposit at the bank, which really created this big vulnerability. And the other part that the startups didn't actually want to pull their money when, you know, this was Wednesday, Thursday, it was the actual sponsor private equity funds that were the investors in the startups that had a fiduciary duty to their investors. They were the ones that really drove them and said, you've got to pull the money out. This is fiduciary money for investors. So that's a very different dynamic than you think of kind of a typical bank, community bank, or credit union, where it's not that profile, right? It's small businesses and it's individuals that have just a very different dynamic in terms of how, you know, a lot of them are going to be insured. It just creates a different run dynamic than what Silicon Valley Bank had.
Interesting. So I guess, you know, if we can kind of put this all into perspective, what has happened is certainly awful. I mean, hearing about bank failures and especially very large banks failing is scary. I mean, I'm not going to pretend it's like no big deal. It's obviously a cause for concern. And if you think about the ripple effects it could have throughout the economy. But as far as your everyday listener who's out there going, hey, should I be worried then? Is my money safe in a bank? It really sounds like the answer to that is yes. I can have confidence in the fact that my money's insured. Assuming I'm not banking, you know, I've got my $5,000 account at this huge Silicon Valley Bank or some other tech bank, but I'm at my local with people like me, we're probably relatively safe. But having said that, there's so many things we've said today and you've said today that I think just play into our everyday personal finance lives that we need to be thinking about. You know, you don't invest money for the long term, you know, in something risky, it's long term risk or interest rate risk or market risk, when you might need it soon. Okay.
So, yep.
That was a bank mistake. That was their mistake. But we as individuals don't want to make those mistakes with our own money. If you do happen to have over that insured limit, you're going to want to spread out your risk.
Spread your risk. Okay.
Spread your risk. So diverse principles of diversification. And also possibly don't get so caught up in the fear, the, you know, what's being painted, the picture of bank failures, and cause a panic that, you know, causes you to maybe pull all your money out and put it under your mattress or something.
Sure.
Don't know how safe it's going to be there, but... So, bank failures, not fun. There's been a few. By the way, for anybody who's curious, you can get on the FDIC website, so fdic.gov. You can actually see a list of bank failures that have taken place. You know, if you go back over the last 10 years, there's been probably about 100 bank failures. But we hear about these ones because they're so large. You know, you can be curious, you can look at these things, it's important to know, but bottom line, I think all of us need to think about our own personal financial situation, ask ourselves, you know, what's the best thing for me? Just take some confidence in the fact that it's insured and protected and go from there. So,
yeah, it's a great ending, Chris.
Well, Seth, I really appreciate you being on the show. We like to see our ISU alum that, you know, have been off doing amazing things. College of Idaho is very lucky to have you right now, and we are very lucky to have had you on the show and appreciate you being with us.
Thanks, Chris.
The Bengal Financial Literacy Show, hosted by ISU's Chris Chatwin, can be heard every third Monday at 7:30 p.m. on KISU-FM. Shows are produced at KISU Studios in Pocatello. Audio of this and all past episodes of Bengal Financial Literacy Show can be found at KISU.org or from Spotify and other select podcast services. Music was produced by Joseph Emanuel under the direction of the ISU Commercial Music Program. Major funding support for KISU local programming comes from the Associated Students of Idaho State University.